Well, good morning. I think I'm supposed to make some hair comment, and I don't know what to make.
Excuse me, Joe.
Pointing.
You just announced that we have a black Honda CRV in the parking lot that's running.
Okay.
This car's out there running a black Honda CRV.
Everybody hear that? Black Honda CRV, it is running. That's probably not good. So let's bow our heads and close our eyes, and then you can get Actually, you don't need to feel embarrassed if you have one of those vehicles. Yeah, so, wow, what a good morning already. Just my heart is full. And this is the last of a series of sermons going through Ephesians 5 and dealing with marriage. And for those of you that aren't married, I'm glad you're here again. I say that, I think, every week, that I think there's principles to be learned, and hopefully you found that to be the case. And I've entitled this sermon series of four, God's or Marriage, God's Very Good Idea. And last week we had a testimony of a couple and that's the way we began. And so I'm gonna do the same thing this week. So I've asked the Dragons, Mike and Pat, if they would come and share a little bit about what marriage is like so you can hear someone that's actually a practitioner. They've actually been married for a while, and you'll talk about that, I think. And I think it's just, isn't it just good to just hear from others? And again, I've mentioned before that many of you, I'm sure, could give testimonies. But so Mike and Pat Dragon, we appreciate you guys in a number of different arenas in the church. And I've got the same three questions I asked last week. And the first one is just tell us a little bit about your marriage, your wedding, and life, and family, and whatever. It's kind of a springboard question.
And we have 25 minutes.
And you have, 2.5 minutes.
We made notes so we could keep it close to... We're both from Terre Haute, Indiana, both born and raised. I grew up on the northeast side. She grew up on the southeast side. We are high school sweethearts. And our first date was my junior prom. Then a few years later, we got married in Pat's second year of college. And since she was in college, we scheduled our wedding over the Thanksgiving weekend so that we could make sure we had a few days of honeymoon before she had to go back to classes on Monday. But she skipped Monday, so it was Tuesday.
So we are both graduates of Indiana State University. And we have been married for 48 years.
48.
This November. So we're kind of drafting off Bob and Jan Channel, who've been married 58. We have three children. Two of them are married, and our two married families have blessed us with 10 grandchildren. Mm-hmm. So we are just really overwhelmed with all of them. We love them dearly, and that's part of our joy, is being able to disciple some of our grandchildren.
Yeah, that's great.
One other thing.
Yeah, go
we
for it.
We both serve in ministry together with One Mission Society.
Yeah, which has been a blessing to them and I think to you guys as well. Well, what's one area of difficulty that, and again, I think part of the beauty of this is to realize, you know what, we're all in this thing together and there are days when it can be challenging. Maybe just one area that you've maybe had a struggle or challenge in your marriage.
Well, with 48 years of marriage, you're bound to have lots of struggles. But our first struggle that really almost tore our family apart was a year and a half in. We had never really learned how to resolve conflict. I came from a non-Christian family, and when we would get angry at each other, we'd just yell and get it all out on the table. And Mike grew up in a Christian home that they kept things calm. They would sit down and they would talk through their issues. Well, when we would have a disagreement, he wouldn't know how to handle my yelling, so at first he would become very silent. Well, that would make me angrier. And so I would yell louder, and then he would walk out of the door, which just really threw me through the roof. And but I was a Christian, and God was convicting me of those anger issues. But I had gotten so fed up with it because we couldn't resolve anything. It just kept building and building. And it got so bad that I finally was done. And I went to a lawyer and I filed for divorce. And then I went home. And my non-Christian father sat me down in his office and he looked at me and he said, he reminded me, first of all, of my wedding vows that I'd made just a year and a half ago. And he looked at me square in the eye and said, What you have to decide is, are you going to be a woman of your word? Or are you just going to continue this cycle of not being able to deal with your issues and just running? Well, that went straight to my heart. And I realized that as a Christian, I couldn't do that. And I really did love him. And so it was our parents that helped us through that hard time, sitting down, talking about our issues with us, and helping us come up with a plan.
The good news is it was resolved over the weekend, so Monday we were back together, and that's why we're still 48 years, so it never really got completed. But what did we learn? We both learned that marriage is hard work, and you have to find some common ground in communications especially. And so how do you do that? And we learned this principle. We both had to surrender our wills to Christ to make the holy covenant of marriage work. Like Joe said a few weeks ago, marriage is about making us holy, not just happy.
Good. So then the third, and you've kind of already alluded to this, and thank you, by the way, for being willing to be honest. I mean, isn't it good? I mean, the church is not made up of people with facades. It's people that are willing to be honest. So what's a lesson? You mentioned one lesson. Did you have another? Or, yeah, figured there may be a lesson or two you've learned in 48 years.
We're going to keep it to three.
Yeah. The one is three. It multiplies.
Well, first thing you have to define is, what is your role? I mean, we just read scripture in Ephesians. We've been studying it this month. What is your role in marriage? Well, my role as the husband is to lead the family. And I have to help Pat, not because I want to, but because it's part of our covenant of marriage vows, to become the godly woman that God wants her to be. Not what I want her to be, but what does God want her to be?
And then in my role, I had to realize that my job is not to change him. That's God's. But my role is to love him, to pray for him, to support him, and to respect him and the decisions that he makes. I need to be there right by his side. And that way, God can turn him into the man of God that he wants. It's not me making changes to satisfy what I want, to make me happy. It's what makes God happy.
It doesn't mean we don't disagree at times either, but we found a way of how can we agree on those things to help our marriage. The second and last one, or maybe third, is that if it's a biblical marriage, how do you talk about your spouse is very important. How you talk about your spouse. And so we were in a small group one time, and this time of, we were studying Ephesians, as a matter of fact, and this young couple, the wife says, is it all right if I share this thing about it? And she whispers in her ear. He says, yeah, that's okay. And so she shares something about their life and their marriage. And then she looks at him and says, did I represent us well? And like, oh, you know, I just like, wow, is that how I treat my spouse? Do I represent her well? And so that's the other lesson is, do I represent my spouse well when I talk about her? Or do I represent us as a couple well when we talk about us? And so that has helped us to say, you know, this really doesn't need to be said at times. But Joe, thank you for letting us share a little bit about our marriage. We're still working at it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing. Was that good? We appreciate you guys very, very much. Well, I don't know about you, but that's encouraging just to hear other people that have grown in grace and grown through through the Spirit working in their hearts. So we're at the last of four sermons from this text in Ephesians. And at the beginning of this series, for those of you that were here, I asked you if you were married to rate your marriage. And I'm sure all of you did that, because when a pastor says something, you just do it. I know. And maybe you didn't, but you could, in your own mind, think from 1 to 5, 1 being it's terrible, awful, horrible, you're getting ready to go see a lawyer, or maybe already have, or 5, it's like you're in heaven. And probably most of you are in neither one of those, but there may be a 2, 3, and 4. And my encouragement was, take advantage of going through Ephesians 5 to move the needle at least a little bit, maybe to think of one thing or one area that you could improve in if you're married. And I hope you've thought about that. And at the end of the sermon this morning, I'm going to give us just a moment of silence. And I'm going to say, would you commit before God, first of all, to say, God, bless my marriage, if you're married. And then to say, and God, there's one area or two or whatever. And maybe you could even pray together as a couple. That's legal. You can do that in church. And just to make a commitment at the end. And if you're single, you're not married, we're glad you're here. And you can think about your relationship with the Lord, that you would ask God, make my relationship with you stronger. And what can you do to move your love for him to be more affirming and more and stronger? Because that's what God desires for his people. So today, and in each one of the weeks, I've had one word that would reflect what I think Paul is talking about in the text. The first week, you might remember, was complement, that the husband and wife have different, they're equal in essence, equal in who they are, and yet they complement each other. The second week was holy. Appreciate you guys remembering that. Maybe marriage and all of life is designed by God more to make us holy than happy. And when we're holy, we're going to be happy. And then last week, we talked about permanence. So it was complement, holy, permanent. This week, the word is heart, H-E-A-R-T. And for those of you that are using the booklet that I gave at the beginning, I changed the words in there. And I think that's legal. Now, even Naomi was really gracious. She does these slides, and she changed it for me this morning, I think. Is it right? Yeah. And so this is a phrase I came up with, and Ben sometimes comes up with these phrases he thinks are really good. I think this is really good. So it's like the heart of a marriage is the heart. How about that? You guys are obviously impressed. The heart of a marriage is the heart. I want to talk about heart this morning. And you know what? The heart issue is a huge issue in the Bible. As a matter of fact, let me just give you an introduction, a little kind of biblical theology of heart, because that's what I'm into, that kind of stuff. The word heart is used 178 times in the New Testament. There you go. That's the numeric. And as a matter of fact, I looked at it in the whole of the scriptures. It's used like 900 times between the Old and the New Testament. It doesn't always mean what I'm going to talk about this morning. Sometimes it is that organ that pumps in your chest that's really crucial. But frequently, particularly in the New Testament and in the Old Testament, the idea of heart is a metaphor for the innermost you. You know, that heart. It's, and I looked up a definition of it, it's the center or the seat of your spiritual life. It's like that, you kind of know what it is. We use that metaphor. The Bible also used a similar metaphor. It used the word bowels for that. That just doesn't work as well for me. Heart is just feels cooler or better or whatever. And even in the Bible, in 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about the secrets of the heart. The depth of the heart. And so I wanted, I like to do visual aids, and so I thought I would do a heart visual aid, and I was trying to find a heart visual aid, and here's the one I found, and you probably can't see it. Can you see it? All right, can you see it in the back? If you can't, you ought to come up and see it. It's a heart, and I'm just going to tell you, Kathy didn't draw this heart, but here's what it says, to Granddad, love Alex. Yeah, and you ought to say, aw. And Alex is one that I just baptized a little less than a year ago. And I didn't even remember I had this. I was just digging through, I need to find a visual aid, and there it is. There's something about that depth. And she has a cross in the middle, no less. And I'm like, yeah, she gave me another one too. I had two of them from her. I don't know where. This one is really cool. Here's what it says. Hi, I just learned to ride a bike with no training wheels. I mean, that's in her writing. You talk about getting excited. Yes. I'm very excited for Grand Camp. That's what Kathy and I, we do in the summer. And then she says, I hope you like your new house because we moved here. And then she said, love Alex. And then she said, God is with you. And it's a heart with a cross in the middle. And I think, man, train a little girl that knows how to draw a heart and put a cross in the middle. You see, it's that deep, kind of deeper than what you'd normally think surface-wise. That's heart. And I'm convinced that there's two aspects to heart in the scriptures. One is affection, and the other is action. And sometimes, back in the day, like 100 years ago when liberalism kind of came into theology, actually it was longer than that. It started in Germany, and actually it's been around for a long time, that denied the Bible. And so if you went to a liberal church, you would probably hear about love. I mean, because liberals are into love, 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 love. And so conservatives said, all right, if liberals like love, we better not. So then we talked about duty, 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 you know, that love is what you do, and love is what you do, but love starts out with a heart, doesn't it? I mean, love starts out with an inclination toward. It starts out with affection for. It's like Kathy and I will say very frequently, we love each other. Every now and then, she'll say to me, poor lady, I mean, she's going to be so glad when this series is over. And she'll say, look in my eyes and say, I love you. And, you know, so I'm a guy and I think, what's the eye thing? You know, what's up with that? You know what it is? She wants to see inside of me. And then I'm like, I don't know that I want to be seen inside. And yet then I think, yeah, we do want to be seen inside. And love is affection. Jonathan Edwards wrote a book. You guys were in Jonathan Edwards' turf, right? Not too long ago, he wrote one of his famous books or treatises was on religious affection. And he was grappling with, because there was a time in New England back in the 1700s when there was this huge revival. It's called the Great Awakening. And it almost seemed like everybody in New England had become a Christian. And it lasted for just a couple years, and then it kind of fizzled out. And Jonathan Edwards said, what happened? And his conclusion was, and believe me, it's a really wordy, long conclusion in that treatise, but his conclusion was that there wasn't a heart for God. There were some actions. Some of them were pretty overt. People were very demonstrative. But there wasn't that heart that was inclined to God. There wasn't that heart that in Ezekiel it says, I'm going to take your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. That didn't happen, and so therefore it was just a temporary, not permanent. There's this idea of affection. Or, this is one of my, I'm not into music particularly, I've said that before, but there is one musical that I really like. It's The Fiddler on the Roof. You guys into Fiddler on the Roof? You know, you got a Fiddler on the Roof? Well, one of the greatest songs of Fiddler on the Roof is the song where the old Jewish guy, and he's probably not that old now that I think about it, but, you know, first time I saw it, he seemed old. They'd been married 25 years, he and his wife. And you remember that song? Some of you remember that. He said to her, Goldie, is that how you pronounce her name? Golda, yeah. Do you love me? Maybe you guys aren't in, maybe you're not cultured enough. You need to go home and pull it, do you love me, do you love me? I mean, it's like out of the blue, he's asking, do you love me? And she looks at him, she says, do I love you? What are you talking about? And then I'm skipping some of this. She says, for 25 years, I've washed your clothes, cooked your meals, cleaned your house, given you children, milked the cow. How many of you have done that? Some of you, probably. After 25 years, why talk about love now? What's up with that? I mean, this is this old crusty guy, you know. And he said, I remember the first time I met you was on our wedding day because it had been an arranged Jewish marriage. He hadn't seen her before their wedding day, and he was told that, you know what, you'll get to love her. So we've been at it 25 years. Do you love me? And then she says, do I love you? For 25 years, I've lived with you, I've fought with you, I've starved with you for 25 years, my bed was yours. If that's not love, what is? And then they conclude, then you love me? And she said, no, I suppose so. And then he said, well, I suppose so too. And then they go on. And you know, the point of that, and the reason I thought it was even worth doing a sermon is because here's the question for the morning. And it's a kind of a twofold question, and that is your heart. Do you love God? And you can say, as a matter of fact, some people will say, hey, you know what? Here's what I've done. I've gone on mission trips. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, there's some that are going to come to me on that day, and we're going to say, we cast out demons. We did all this. And then he's going to say, I never knew you because you never came to the point where you put your faith and trust in, where you gave your heart to him. I don't know if it's giving your heart to him or you took, it's that heart thing. It's that trust thing. It's that affection thing. Do you love God? And then in a marriage sermon series, I'm going to say, do you love your spouse? And you can say, I've done a lot of stuff for her or for him, but is your heart connected to your innermost being? Do you love? Do you want? Do you cherish? That's what I think the heart is all about. The heart of marriage is the heart. And it's affection, and don't miss that part. But it's also action, and don't miss that part either. Because that action part is to say, God loved the world, which I think was an affection, so he gave his son, and that giving means he gave him in death. Husbands, love your wives, and you'll love your wife like Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. That marriage is going to be made up of two people who come together and say, we have affection for each other, and we also are going to give action to that affection. We love each other, and we're going to live according to the way that you would if you loved someone. Our actions and our affections are going to come together. And I think that's what a heart is. And so I'm going to pray this for myself and for our church, that we have people that have hearts and that their hearts are just ignited and that there's an affection to it, but then there's also action, and they go together like faith and works to produce a group of people who know how to love well. And by the way, love, as we'll see in this text, I've got 2 points to the sermon this morning, and there's 2 verses. And love has 2 directions. One is vertical, love God. The other is horizontal, love your neighbor. So if you're single, that works for you, right? I mean, it does. And if you're married, it works in a unique way where you together as a couple love God, and then you as a couple love one another, or you have a heart for one another. So there's 2 objects, vertical and horizontal. Let's look at the last 2 verses of Ephesians 5 and see how Paul fleshes this out. In verse 32, Paul says, this mystery is profound. And Paul is starting, the couple has a heart for God. He's starting this vertical relationship discussion. I say he's starting, he's actually completing it. These last 2 verses, I think, are a summary of all Paul has said. And he starts off with, this mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ in the church. And I say, all right, Paul, you've talked about Christ in the church 4 times already in these couple of verses. Now you add the word mystery. What is the mystery? And the word mystery, that's another interesting New Testament word, interesting Bible word. It's used 27 times in the New Testament. Aren't you glad I got a computer that does this analysis? And it does it really quick. You just hit a button. It says 27 times. It'll give you all 20. 7 of them are in Ephesians. That's almost a third. Per my really good math, 27. Actually, it's not 27, it's 24 and 7. You know, it's about a third. Paul uses mystery a lot, and I thought this would be a good thing. So some of you that are Bible students and want to get extra credit, write a paper on Paul's use of mystery in Ephesians. And I'd be glad to read it, and I'll give you a grade for it. And none of you will do that, but it sounds like a good idea. And Paul uses it, like one of the illustrations is when Paul talks about the coming together of Jew and Gentile, he says that's a mystery. And the idea of mystery is there was a time when it wasn't understood, and now it is understood. It isn't like you're never going to be able to figure it out. It was like, hey, you know what the church is? The church is to be made up of people. It is made up of people that are of all ethnicities, of all genders, of all ages, of singles and married people. That's what the church is, and there's a mystery to that, in that in the Old Covenant, it seemed like it was only Jewish only, and now it's been opened up. And then Paul says, this idea of husband and wife is to be reflective of Christ and the church. And that's a mystery that now is revealed, because what Paul has been arguing for in all of his epistles is that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, and then that salvation is going to bring together all the people of God so that his glory will cover the earth like the water covers the sea. So he says, this mystery is profound, and I'm saying it refers to Christ in the church. And I try to think of some mysteries that were profound in my life. Do you remember? I remember Actually, I don't remember, but I kind of remember the first time that I realized there were girls in the world, or even that there was a difference between a girl and a boy. I mean, do you remember that? All right. I don't remember exactly, but then I also remember a time when I thought, girls are pretty good. And there might have been a time when I thought, not so much. I'm not sure. I don't really remember that. But I do remember the time when I thought, hey, this girl thing is kind of cool. And, you know, it's almost like this mystery. I don't even know that it was a mystery, but this unknown suddenly becomes more known. And that's kind of cool. Or maybe a little not quite as personal an illustration. Kathy and I like to watch British mysteries. Kathy likes to watch British mysteries. And I do, too. Because she's kind of led me down that path. And the British mystery is always somebody gets killed, you know, or most of the time. You got to get killed. So, you know, there's going to be a death. This is just fun. Let's watch another murder. And then the mystery unfolds. And, you know, every murder is the guy got, he was killed. He's in a room. It's locked from the inside. There's no way somebody could kill him and get out. And there's no fingerprints on the gun, you know, and there's no witnesses, and everybody has an alibi, and so there's no hope. And then at the end, you know, the great detective with his British accent, he just unfolds it all, and you say, ah, now I see that. No, no doubt that guy did it. There's this mystery, and Paul isn't saying that marriage is a mystery. He's saying that the unfolding of the mystery is that your marriage is to reflect your heart for God. That it's bigger than you. And it's profound. And by profound, he doesn't mean you can never understand it. What he means by that is, it is unbelievable. It's spectacular that in your marriage, you can reflect Christ and the church. You can have this vertical perspective. Your heart can be further in love with God because of your marriage. In Genesis 2, which is what Paul springboards off for this, Adam loved Eve. It doesn't use that word loved, but it does say he saw her. I mean, the whole thing sets up. Like, can you imagine Adam saying, all right, Eve, that's a pretty good option. I think I'll wait for the next option. You know, maybe I'm going to date around a little bit. I mean, so who's he going to date around with? It's like, you got one option, Adam. It's Eve. That's the option. There you go. And you have, I mean, I think it would be fair to say Adam loved Eve. I know it's fair to say this, the second Adam loved the church. Second Adam being Jesus, and Paul uses that analogy, loved the church. And therefore, we the people of God in our marriages ought to reflect and show our love for God in our marriages. So let me give you two applications. One is an application of affection, and I'll ask you this question as a couple. Do you love God? If we were to do a musical, would God come to you and say, do you love me? And what's the answer? And if you're a Christian, you're going to say, yeah, God, I love you. And say, do you really? You remember, Jesus actually did ask that question. You remember who he asked it to? Yes, it's to Peter. You remember that? It's the very end of John. And just a couple of chapters earlier, remember Peter denied Jesus three times. And I thought about that. Peter was in the inner circle. Peter was one of the Peter, James, and John. Those were like Jesus guys, you know. And then on that eventful night of Jesus' betrayal, and then the morning leading to his death, and Peter, you remember, I mean, in the garden, Peter cut the guy's ear off, and I'm pretty convinced it's because he missed his head. It's like, and then he got the ear. I mean, it's like he's the trooper. And then he denies Jesus three times around a fire and says, I don't know him, I don't know him, I don't know him. And then Jesus looks at him, and that's had to have been one of the most glaring looks of all looks. And then Jesus dies. He raises from the dead, and then at the end of John, there's this, I think, endearing narrative. And it's a narrative where Jesus and Peter meet each other, and Jesus says to Peter three times, Pete, do you love me? And you know what Peter's answer was? I love you. And they use different words, and some people have said Peter's kind of giving a half-hearted love. I don't think so. I think they're both synonyms, and I think he's saying, Jesus, I love you. And then Jesus says, do you love me? And why did he ask three times? I don't know. Maybe. I think probably it was Jesus' way of saying, you've denied me three times, and my grace is going to be so extensive to you that I'm going to take you back. And I think he was saying to Peter, in your deep innermost being, do you love me? And then he says, if you love me, your affection is going to translate into action. Feed my sheep. If you love me, you keep my commandments. But the first question is, do you love me? If you're here this morning, and we like in our sermons to make sure that we give an invitation to those who may not be followers of Jesus. And maybe you're here this morning, maybe you think you have, but you've never had that affection, that love for God. If you're here this morning and you don't know Jesus, I can tell you the greatest love story ever is the love story of God loved the world, and that means the people of the world, that he sent his only son, gave his only son, that whoever believes in him wouldn't perish but have eternal life. And I think, wow, that's the God I want to love. That's the God I want to give my heart to. And giving my heart means my innermost affection, reality, that when God gives life to my heart, he's the one that I want to be my Savior. And man, I tell you what, the good news today is you can trust in Jesus. He loves you, and your response can be, you can love him because he first loved you. And I would encourage you with that. And for those of us that are believers, well, I would ask the question, do you love him? I mean, and you would say, yeah, you do. And probably on some level you do. Like you would say you love your spouse. But is your heart fully given to him? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength. So how do you do that? How do you do that as a couple? How do you increase your love for God? How do you give your heart to him? And I mentioned in the first sermon an application. These are two really, really practical ones that you could do together as a couple as you want to lift your hearts, your affection toward God. The action you could take is, I'm going to be in his word. We're going to be in his word. We're going to read the scriptures together. We're going to grow in grace together. We're going to grow to love God more together. We're going to pray together more than just, thank you for this food. I've even noticed some Christians don't even do that anymore before the meals. That used to be, you can't eat if you didn't bless the food, and if you don't bless the food, you might die, you know, that kind of a thing, which I don't think is true. But are we in love with God and then in love with God together? Which I think is what Paul has been saying in this whole text, and I think that's what he's saying in verse 32. He says, this mystery is profound. The profound mystery is your marriage gives you the opportunity together as a couple to love God, to have your hearts drawn toward him. We used to sing, this is an old song, My Jesus, I Love Thee. And then, you know it's an old song because it's thee. But there's something about thee that has an endearing sound to it to me, and maybe that's just because my generation. My Jesus, I love thee. I know thou art mine. For thee all the folly of sin I resign. My gracious Redeemer, my Savior art thou. If ever I love thee, my Jesus is now. And well, I would say, and maybe that's a prayer you ought to make at the end of the sermon this morning, is to say, Jesus, I want to love you more, and I want it to be the fullness of my being. My affections and my actions will love you more. You know, it's cool to see a couple, a husband and wife, that decide to go to Morocco. And frankly, I kind of knew where Morocco was. I used to teach geography, and I made my students name, they had to write all the countries of Africa down, and this is a number of years ago, and I never learned them because I knew they were going to change, but they had to do it, and I'd give them a test. And so I'm sure Morocco was probably around there. And I don't mean to pat you guys on the back, but there's something about a couple that says, we love Jesus and we're going to go pursue his kingdom. And maybe that we all shouldn't go to Morocco. Don't do that. But you ought to be looking for opportunities. How can, or the dragons, the same thing. I mean, he had a, I think it was a pretty good job, sounded like a pretty good job, and said, well, maybe God's going to call me to something else, and maybe it's like missions. And again, I don't think everybody has to do that, but you know what, as a couple, do you love Jesus? I ask myself that question. And if ever I love you, my Jesus, 'tis now. So that's vertical. And again, I think this is sort of Paul's summary of the whole thing. You want to know marriage is about, it's about the heart of marriage is the heart. Do you love God? Or are you together? Is your heart given to God? The second one is your heart toward each other. Your heart toward each other. Do you have a heart for each other? And then look at the last verse. And by the way, the last verse is pretty much the same as what he said before, with one kind of exception. Verse 33, it says in my translation, however, there are other translations that translate that word now. I think it's better. I think that's a better translation. It's like he's just transitioning. He's saying, now let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband, period. And then he starts talking about children and parents. It's like, all right, that's my last word to the married couples. And there's something personal about it. Let each one of you. So he's moving away from just the general statement, hey, all you husbands, hey, all you wives, and now it's almost as though he's finishing his kind of sermon part, and he's pointing a finger at us. So I'm going to point a Pauline finger at all of us that are married. And he says this, husbands, just in case you haven't heard it, and I think it's at least the third time or more that he said it, husbands, and he doesn't say husbands, but you understand that because he says wives, love your wife as yourself. And so as we come to the end of this treatment of this epistle, this particular chapter in this epistle, in this sermon series on marriage, I ask myself, because I fit in that role, and you guys, do you love your wives, your wife, not wives, you're only allowed to have one. Yeah, that was a slip. Do you love, as yourself, do you have that love that's self-sacrificing, that love that is a deep affection that turns, that translates into action? Is that the way you are? Is your heart, does your wife have your heart? That's the question. You know, there's been a lot of debate about the roles of marriage and the roles of women in the church. We were listening to a book on an audio book. There's a book, and some of you guys may be into this, and if you're not, stay out of it. But there's sort of this controversy. This has been going on for a long, long time. But we're in a generation now where controversies are the thing. You know, if you can't find something to argue about, then you're not really living. You got to find something to argue about. So arguing about the roles of women in the church, the roles of husband and wife together. There's a book called Jesus and John Wayne. Anybody heard of that book? I'm hoping. Good. You don't need to hear of that book. It does bring up some things because there has been a history, and I mentioned this in the first sermon. There have been times when men have abused their responsibility in marriage, and that's happened a lot, right? Where men have acted like the dictator and I'm just going to slam the wife, and the wife doesn't matter, and that's sin, that's evil, and God hates that. Here's the language that God uses, and it's the language, husbands, love your wife. Give your heart to her. And so I say, is that the way we husbands, is that our perspective? Is that what we do? You want to know what headship is like? Headship is loving like Christ loved the church. And then Paul says, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. And he didn't use that word respect before. That's an interesting word, too. It comes from the word that we get phobia from, phobeomai. And it could be translated fear. Wives, fear your husbands. That doesn't sound like a good translation to me. And there are some translations that translate it that way, but it's similar to the word to fear God. And when you fear God, I mean, there is a sense in which you do fear God if you're going sinning against him, but the core of fear God is to reverence. And the core of it is to esteem highly, and the wives are to not reverence like you reverence God, but to esteem highly your husband, to have that he has a sense of worth, that you hold him in honor, that you show regard for him. And I know the answer, the counter to that. He doesn't deserve it. You know, I'm a husband, and I think, all right, I'm not sure that I fully deserve to be respected, and yet I know this, that God in His grace knows us. He knows that, husband, when you love your wife like Christ loves the church, that's a context in which a marriage will flourish. And wives, when you respect your husband, you say, he doesn't fully respect, he doesn't deserve to be respected. On some level, you could say, you don't fully deserve to be loved either, right? I mean, if we're going to say, what do we deserve? But we're going to say, we're going to do what God calls us to do. And I thought your testimony was so helpful for me. That and does God, I don't think it's a guarantee that every time it's going to work in every marriage. I think there are cases where sin is so prevalent. But the general rule of thumb is, husbands, love your wives, give your heart. And I think the respect is saying, wives, give your heart to your husband. Do you think he's saying by that, wives, you don't have to love your husbands? Don't worry about loving your husbands, just respect them. I don't think so. Is it, husbands, just love your wives, you don't need to respect them? Is it even possible you could love your wife and not respect her? I don't think so. And yet I think the lead is going to be, husbands, you give your heart to your wife, you're going to love her, and then her response will be a response of respect and love, and you'll respect, and it's just kind of this interplay of complementarian reality. And man, isn't that beautiful? Don't we all wish that all 48 years of our marriage were like that? And yet, I can tell you this, make the next day of your marriage like that. There you go, that's what you got. And make the next week, and the next month. Let me give you just a couple quick applications, and then I'm gonna give us a time to reflect. First of all, in affection, I would say this, husbands, do you love your wives? Have you given your heart to your wife? Wives, have you given your heart, your affections? And you know what? I think a lot of us would say, if you've been married for 48 years, and I haven't, but if you had, you might say, it's not like it used to be, you know? I mean, those butterflies from the first, I hope you had a butterfly or two at the beginning. And you'd say, you know, after a period of time, butterflies tend to go away. And on some level, butterflies going away isn't all bad, but here's what we ought to do, church. If you're married, you ought to say, God, restore to me the butterflies is the right word, but my affection, so that there's one that I have affection toward, and that's God. And like God loves, like God has affection for the church, I'm going to have that kind of affection for my spouse. And I think, wow, what could God do if you sincerely prayed that prayer? And then there's actions that you could take. Actions like, boy, if you're a husband loving your wife, you're going to spend time, you're going to give attention to, you're going to communicate. And I think you mentioned a number of those in your testimony this morning. And if you respect your husband, or if you respect your wife, but if you respect your husband, you're not going to be demeaning. It isn't going to be, you know, how could you cut the grass like that, or whatever. I mean, I don't know if anyone's ever been non-respectful to somebody else, but I'm guessing you probably have. And our goal and mission in life is going to be that we give our hearts to each other. We love, we respect, and we do it because that reflects the glory of God. So in conclusion, we've had 4 weeks. We've talked about husband and wife complementing each other, our marriage allowing us to grow in holiness. We've talked about the permanence of marriage, and then we've talked about the heart of marriage. And I'd like you to think and spend a little time reflecting. If you're married this morning, pray, and at least pray this, that God would bless your marriage. And what does that mean? God, bless my marriage. Well, I think it's going to mean, God, give my heart, or help me to know how to give my heart to my spouse and all that it's entailed in that, that we're going to become one flesh. And then help us to have that heart for you, Lord. Bless our marriage. And maybe there's some area, maybe it's in your roles, maybe as wives, you're saying, boy, I got some work to do. Maybe it's husbands. I know we husbands got work to do. And maybe it's in one area to say, God, by your grace, let's start moving that needle. Start moving it toward Him. And, you know, if you're here this morning and you don't fit this sermon series, you don't have a spouse to use to have application, maybe you're single, maybe you've lost a spouse. We have people in our church like that. By the way, we love our single people. We love those that that God's taken their spouses. Maybe you've had abuse in your past. Maybe you've got an ungodly spouse. And maybe you're recognizing, you know what, I'm the ungodly spouse. Maybe you just don't, and I guess in those cases you do kind of fit the scenario here, but it's hard to figure out how to make it work. Boy, I tell you what, pray that God will give you all the grace you need, because God's promised, I'll give you grace. And then find your ultimate hope in Jesus. Your spouse isn't Jesus. Whether it's a husband or wife, you can find hope in him. For some of you, this is my day of salvation. I need to trust in him. For those of us that have, it's to say, my Jesus, I love you. And if you need help, get some help. Come to the church. Come to your friends. Talk to people, because that's what the church is about. So we're going to take probably a minute or two, and I want you to just spend a moment of time reflecting and say, God, open my eyes. Search me, O God, know my heart. And at least, if you're married, pray, God, bless our marriage. And if you're single, say, God, bless my relationship with you. And then for those of us, if you're married, say, God, maybe there's something in my marriage that I need to conform to your will and to your love. I want to give my heart to my spouse. And I'm going to give you a moment. You can pray with your spouse if you happen to be next to your spouse. That's okay. That's legal. And let's just have a moment where we just lift our hearts to God, and then I'll close in prayer, and then we're going to sing a song in conclusion.